Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Florida's presidential primary is only 5 months away. Can you believe it? But hundreds of thousands of people in this state still don't know if they can legally vote in the 2020 election. And that's because of legal issues that are still surrounding Amendment 4. That was a measure passed by a majority of Florida voters almost a year ago to restore the right to vote for residents in this state with a previous felony conviction after they served their sentences.
Yeah, but state lawmakers then passed a law that requires people with felony convictions to pay all their court fines and fees in order to regain the right to vote in Florida. Now, that law is the focus of a federal court fight. The outcome could decide if thousands of people can register to vote for municipal elections across the state that are happening next month, let alone, Melissa, the presidential election cycle and all the things that are happening in 2020.
That's right, Tom. And in Florida, where these elections tend to be really close, the fate of Amendment 4 and how this legal fight is decided could make a big difference in how Florida's 29 electoral votes are awarded in 2020. We're going to begin the hour this Friday here on the Florida Roundup with a closer look at the issue of voting rights in Florida. Here are some questions for you to ponder. Are you wondering, what are the voting rules for people with a felony conviction in this state? Are you maybe someone who's tried to register to vote and couldn't because of a previous felony conviction? And what's your opinion? Do you think fines tied to a felony conviction should be paid before someone can cast a ballot again or not? Give us a call wherever you are in the state here on the Florida Roundup. The number to join us is 305-995-1800. Already getting your tweets? Send them to @FloridaRoundup.
Yeah, if you thought the vote on Amendment 4 back in 2018 was the end of the debate, far, far from it. That debate continues raging here as municipal elections are coming in the next few weeks in several communities here in Florida. So let's talk about this with Daniel Rivero, reporter with WLRN Miami. Gary Fineout is with Politico. And Neil Voles is with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Neil joins us from Fort Myers and WGCU. Neil, let me start with you. Can felons who've served their prison term in Florida register to vote today?
Thanks for having us on and shining light on this important issue. And as one of those people who had a past felony conviction, I'm registered to vote and I'm eligible to vote. And I would just say that, you know, while we're not a party in the court case, we are the people and the organization most impacted by these decisions, and definitely appreciate this conversation and look forward to kind of digging into where we are right now and where we're going.
Danny Rivero, you've been covering the court case. Where is it? And tell us what the judge will decide and also some of the comments he's been making about the mess around Amendment 4's implementation.
Right. So this week, the judge, federal district judge, Robert Hinkle, he heard arguments from the state and also from different plaintiffs, many of whom were people who have felony convictions and registered to vote, and in some cases did vote after Amendment 4 went into effect. So he heard arguments this week, and he hasn't given an opinion on where he falls on those questions. And those questions are, for this case, there's a couple of them, but one of them is, does requiring people to pay certain fines and fees before they register to vote, is that constitutional in itself? And then there's another question that's tied up in this, is the state's rollout of it. Now that the legislature passed and Governor DeSantis signed SB 7066 earlier this year, there's been, by the state's own admission, a lot of confusion about how you verify if someone is eligible to vote or not. There's a lot of state agencies involved. There's local governments involved. And by the state's own admission, the rollout has not been smooth. And in many cases, they're simply not able to tell someone if they're able to vote. And if you want to vote and you're trying to figure it out on your own, a lot of people are saying, I can't figure it out.
Didn't the judge call it an administrative nightmare?
He did call it an administrative nightmare.
Gary Fineout, you were in court for these arguments. Tell us, what was that like? What was that atmosphere like?
Well, it was very interesting in that most of it dealt with the people who have sued, the plaintiffs, and that includes a lot of individuals who had registered to vote, but turnout have owe some money, and they've sued along with other organizations such as the NAACP and the League of Women Voters. Mm-hmm. And they presented people who explained their situation. They put a supervisor on the stand, and they put somebody from the clerk of the courts on the stand. And the state really, they made some arguments at the beginning of the hearing and at the end of the hearing, but they really didn't put on much of an additional defense. Now, it's important for the listeners to know that this is actually just the first stage. This was a hearing on what they call a preliminary injunction. Mm-hmm. And that's whether or not the judge will block the law ahead of the actual trial, which right now is set for April.
Ways off. Neil Voltz with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. You and the folks with your coalition were successful in getting Amendment 4 on the ballot and getting it passed overwhelmingly by the state's voters last year. Now, its language, it seems, created a loophole that is allowing the legislature to force the formerly incarcerated to pay fines, sometimes in large amounts, before they can vote again. Let's talk about the language. The amendment stated that former inmates had to complete all aspects of their sentences before regaining their voting rights. And by that, you meant serving prison time, probation, and restitution owed to victims or the state. The legislature is saying restitution also includes money, any fees levied by the courts. Critics have said Florida court fees are often too large and don't always have anything to do with restitution to victims. NYU's Brennan Center for Justice studied Amendment 4 in Florida. They allege that it's designed to prevent African Americans from voting, particularly those who are Democratic leaning. I'd like to get your thoughts about that and whether or not you see this fight having to do with voter suppression, which critics have said is what is behind the insistence on paying the fees and fines.
Gosh, that's a great question. A couple layers there. So let me just kind of step back and frame this up and remind the listeners like what the goal of Amendment 4 was. In Florida, for 150 plus years, we had a lifetime ban on voting for people with past felony convictions. And that impacted 1.4 million people in the state. We were one of four states at the time that had that lifetime ban. And so Amendment 4 ended the lifetime ban. And nothing that we're discussing here involves undoing that fundamental step, right? Included in that, like you said, was language that we took years putting together. And what we did was we talked to voters, we talked to people in Florida, and we gauged the appetite for what the public was willing to move forward on. So for instance, allow me to talk about this tension. I am somebody who believes that everybody can be restored. I made mistakes in my life, and I've been blessed to see restoration at work. So I personally believe that somebody who has committed even some of the most heinous crimes, somebody who's committed murder, could be restored and could be eligible to vote. But that is not what was included in Amendment 4, in large part because there was not an appetite for that. So included in the amendment were three issues that you mentioned at the beginning of the question that ultimately needed clarification. One was, what is the definition of murder? Mm-hmm. What is the definition of felony sexual offenses? And what does it mean to complete your sentence? And that is the process that we're currently engaged in. And so I think it's important to kind of frame up the conversation.
Right, because people convicted of a violent crime aren't eligible to vote. Let's be clear on that. Of sexual assault, rape, or murder. Yeah.
That's correct.
And so, Neil, is it your understanding that completing a sentence in Florida includes fines and fees that may be associated with that crime that somebody was convicted of and sentenced to time in prison?
Well, one of the things that I would say is that, you know, when we were discussing this issue with the voters, is that, you know, our theme was that when a debt is paid, it's paid. And we walked all around the state. We talked to people all across the state. And one of the things that we talked about was the restorative process, right? Mm-hmm. That included that if you owed restitution, for instance, that, you know, there was harm done to the community and that in order to fully be restored, that needed to be alleviated, right? So we talked about that idea with the voters. I would say that what we're talking about are some legal principles and that these court decisions are going to, you know, they're going to work themselves out. From our perspective, we are actively engaged in getting people registered to vote. We're actively engaged in helping people with their fines and fees that they might owe. We are operating under the law that passed and was signed into law. There is not a better group of evangelists for democracy in this state than people who lost the ability and now are engaged in becoming full citizens in our community again. On the one-year anniversary of the passage of Amendment 4 next month, we will be engaged in a statewide bus tour in which we will be going all across the state and honestly, just making voting fun again. Like,
yeah.
We believe that there's something really, really cool going on. Yes, there are.
Let's get excited about voting instead of feeling cynical about voting. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think voting ever got boring, but nonetheless, Neil, point made there. Let's take some phone calls, and there's some tweets as well, questions about kind of what does it mean for a sentence to be fulfilled. Dan on line 3 in Fort Lauderdale is up first. Go ahead, Dan. You're on the radio.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When I voted, first I signed a petition several years back to get the amendment on the ballot, and then I voted for the ballot with an overwhelming majority of Floridians, and it never occurred to me that the Republican legislature might try to stop the will of Floridians, and it's very upsetting. I work with people who are incarcerated, who are getting out, who are going to fix their lives, trying to fix their lives. And to withhold that fundamental right of determination, of self-determination, is such a blight on anyone's future. Thanks for taking my call.
Dan, appreciate it. Gary Fineout with Politico. Did that line of thinking, of logic, of argument come into the plaintiff's arguments in court?
Well, yes. I mean, it is important to remember there is a there's a bit of a flurry of debate as to whether or not the proponents of the amendment articulated a point of view that restitution, fines, and fees were in fact included in the amendment. But what we're hashing out now in court is, okay, if is the law that requires that, now that it's spelled out, does that violate the federal constitution? Not the state constitution, but the federal constitution. That's the 24th Amendment having to do with the issue of a poll tax. Does it in fact constitute a poll tax? And there was a lot of interesting back and forth between the judge and the lawyers for both sides about this issue. And even to the point that the judge, he broached a lot of different things. Everything from, is one component of that, the court costs, which are used to pay for the function of the court. Does that violate the 24th Amendment by having that amendment? Also, there's a previous court ruling on the clemency system in Florida in which the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals said you can't have a clemency system that is dependent on people's ability to pay. Mm-hmm. And he's talking to both sides and saying, I don't know how we get around that. And so then he broached the possibility that on the very least, maybe what you have to have is you have to have a system that determines whether or not someone can pay this restitution and fees. And so we're waiting to see how he kind of threads the needle in dealing with these disparate elements.
Okay, lots of tweets on this. Here's one from Ginger, listening to the Florida Roundup. She says, the legislature and the governor have tried to supersede the will of the people. Once your time is served, your rights should be restored. Otherwise, it's taxation without representation. Here is a tweet from Josh. It's pretty simple. We should apply the same plain language understanding of Amendment 4 as people do for the Second Amendment. Preventing former felons from voting because of a technical issue involving outstanding fines subverts the will of the people who voted for the amendment. Danny Rivero, Gary mentioned how what a patchwork it is in this state tracking fines and fees. Let me ask you about this. Restitution, it's my understanding, differs by jurisdiction and even by judge. Sometimes the court clerk collects in a community, sometimes the victim does, sometimes the State Department of Corrections collects. Things can be converted to a civil lien. The state has no idea how much restitution is even owed cumulatively. There's no state agency tasked with tracking this. Many former felons, defendants in court, they don't even know how much they owe. Florida is also among the states that can sometimes charge exorbitant fines for people that have been convicted of even a civil infraction. Mm-hmm. So fines also mount over time. They compound over time. What about the point Gary made that Florida really doesn't have a well-regulated apparatus to track these fines and fees? And that's muddying the waters too, isn't it?
Absolutely. All the things that you said are absolutely true. There is no centralized place where someone can go to find what they owe, if they owe anything. And even the plaintiffs in this case say that they've consulted several databases to try to understand how much they owe, and they've gotten different numbers from every one of them. So there's, even if you can obtain some of this information, it's not consistent and it's not clear what someone could owe. So one of the main things in this case, or at least in the backdrop of this case, is at the local level, the local clerk of courts are the ones that handle a lot of this information. You know, you get arrested for something, you're probably going to be brought up in the local court, and then your local clerk of courts office will hold that information. Well, there's 67 of those those for every county in the state, and each one of those counties has a different records system. They archive differently. Some of them track if you paid once they sent it to a collection agency. Others don't track it. Some of them track it if they convert it into a civil fine. Some don't track it. In I was reading the deposition of Maria Matthews, who's the director of Florida Division of Elections, and she said in Miami-Dade County, the largest county in the state by population, they're having issues because the clerk of court's office sends a lot of those old files for old cases to the police department, and then they don't have relationships with the police department, so they don't know how to get those records. So she said, we literally can't verify in many cases if someone is eligible to vote or not.
You know what's striking about this is how complex it is on the fine and fees that you're discussing. It's just as complex, Gary Fineout, isn't it, on the supervisor election side? There's 67 of those trying to figure out how do you apply Amendment 4 when it is in court and kind of the
do you let someone cast a ballot or not?
Yeah, right.
Well, let's clarify where things are right now. Mm-hmm. Right now, no one's really looking at it. That's the situation. That
supervisors are not looking.
I don't want to get into a long tutorial, but the issue is that
well, we're up against the clock here.
Yes.
But no, in essence, what you do is you fill out a form, you give it to the supervisor, they send it to the Department of State. It's the Department of State that's supposed to pull information to decide whether or not somebody is eligible or not.
Exactly.
And what they're doing right now is they're not sending them any information about whether or not people owe restitution. All they've done since the implementation of the law on July 1st is like, if they find somebody who is definitely disqualified, in other words, they're still actually on probation or something like that, then they're telling the supervisors, you need to pull them off the rolls. But as to people who have fines or restitution, right now it's in limbo. They're not doing anything.
We will continue the discussion on who can vote and who can in Florida as we continue taking your calls about a court fight over Amendment 4. Get on the line now at 305-995-1800, wherever you are in the state. It's the Florida Roundup this Friday. Tweets coming into @FloridaRoundup, getting your emails too. We'll get to those after the break. Where do you stand on this? Do you think someone should have to pay fines, sometimes in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, before they vote or not? Let us know. Let your voice be heard on this issue here on the Florida Roundup, as we'll continue in a moment with Gary Fineout of Political, Danny Rivero of WLRN, and Neil Voltz of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. More conversation in a moment here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about Amendment 4, the constitutional amendment that a majority of Florida voters passed almost a year ago, allowing convicted felons the restoration of the right to vote after completing their sentence. State lawmakers, though, passed an implementation law they felt was necessary, and that law has found its way to a federal court in Tallahassee. And now the fate of the implementation remains in a judge's hand. Talking about that with you at 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or on Twitter at Florida Roundup. Gary Fineout with Politico is with us from our sister station in Orlando, WMFE. Danny Rivero has been covering this issue for WLRN in Miami. Neil Voles is with us as well from WGCU. Neil is with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Neil, as municipal elections are approaching, will you vote?
I look forward to the opportunity to vote as soon as possible here down in Southwest Florida. I know that we're immediately looking at races in Orlando, Miami, St. Petersburg, and there are returning citizens. That's what we kind of call ourselves, those of us with past felony convictions, who will be voting in those races. We are in contact with lots of people. Just a backdrop on our organization real quick is we are a returning citizen-led organization. The 22 chapter leaders in our organization, all returning citizens, we advocate for on behalf of returning citizens across the state. So obviously these issues are very personal to us, and we appreciate the opportunity to kind of put the human experience and people's lives at the heart of the conversation.
Neil, what's your advice for those out there who are in limbo in terms of whether or not they have the franchise? What advice do you have for people? We're talking over a million Floridians who fall into this bucket. They have a prior felony conviction. Amendment 4 was supposed to automatically guarantee them the right to cast a ballot again. Now they really don't know their status. What should people do for information and guidance in this matter?
Well, one of the things that we do is we're in community events and activities all across the state. And so we meet people, you know, one-on-one and in their communities and have these conversations. And the truth is that we're operating under the law that was passed and signed by Governor DeSantis. And under that law, there are hundreds of thousands of people who are immediately eligible to register to vote. And when we interact with somebody like that, we help them register to vote because we believe in the participation in civic engagement and the positive impact that can have for the community and the person involved. If somebody still owes fines and fees, we also have a fines and fees fund in which we're directly helping people get their financial obligations paid. In addition to that, in the law, and if you can bear with me one second, and I'm like Gary, I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but in the law was written some language specifically geared towards people with financial hardships so that you can get access to the court and the court can actually modify your sentence so that you can become eligible to vote. And so in jurisdictions across the state, we are actually working with the chief judge, the clerks, the state attorneys to set up programs. And we have thousands of people already in the pipeline who are working through that process to verify their financial hardship, and then that local district is able to then modify their sentence to allow that person to vote.
So that they
so
could
there's
afford
a lot of moving parts
that,
here.
So that they could afford whatever the fine is. Is that the thing? I mean, these fine amounts, Tom and guys, they range. There's no rhyme or reason. A misdemeanor conviction for some violations is $25. For others, it could be as high as $500. Trafficking marijuana, that's a $200,000 fine. State Senator Jeff Brandes said, these fees and fines are completely inappropriate, especially in the context of Amendment 4, because there doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason to how they're applied.
And Danny, we have seen some local prosecutors step into this fray, as Neil is talking about his group working with local law enforcement to address this. What can local prosecutors, county state's attorneys, do in this regard?
So here in Miami-Dade is an example of something. So the state attorney's office here, the clerk of court's office, the local courts have actually bonded together to try to figure out a way that they can address this as a, you know, in collaboration with each other. And what the hope is that if you're having trouble paying off some of these fines or fees, that you can go to the court and you can go to the clerk of courts, and the prosecutors that work the case can kind of work with you in order to essentially get your rights restored if monetary things is what's standing in between you and your right to vote.
It's 305. Sure, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. That's one of the things that's happening. Another thing is there's clerk of courts offices from across the state are are also doing their own thing in this regard. There's this thing called Operation Greenlight, which is basically an amnesty, because if you owe fines or fees and you fall behind in those payments, the state allows collection agencies, if it gets sent to collections, to put up to a 40% on top of what you owed. So the Operation Greenlight is happening actually later this month all across the state, where they're going to be waiving a lot of those additional fines to help people pay them off without those additional fees.
Additional fees. 305-995-1800. Will is on the line in Miami Gardens right now. Hey, Will, go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon. Yes, I was just really want to comment and kind of disappointed about the legal system, the justice system, you know, again, making things about money again after somebody has paid their debt to society. It's just appalling. And I had an opportunity to go visit the clemency board up in Tallahassee, and just to hear certain people of, let's say, African-American descent, you know, trying to run for city council and do productive things in their community, and they were denied. Versus I saw white males go up there who said they had old World War II veterans that they wanted to go shoot with their sons and grandsons, and were approved. I mean, it's just appalling to see it's just crazy. I'm very disappointed, and I hope that this gets resolved, because this shouldn't be going on.
Okay, I hear you, Will. Let's close this out with Gary Fineout. What can we expect out of when can we expect a ruling from the judge? What's the road ahead here?
Well, I think we can expect a ruling relatively soon. I think he clearly indicated that he would like to get the preliminary injunction out of the way, and then we have a trial would be in April. And we have a lot of things on parallel tracks. I think we also have the state Supreme Court that's been asked to give an advisory opinion to the governor. And I would not be surprised if the legislature also kind of wades back into this amid everything that's happened. And their session starts in January, so it wouldn't be surprising to me if there's a follow-up. And then lastly, we've got Nikki Fried, the agriculture commissioner. She would like the clemency board to sort of deal with this as well. What gets lost in all of this is, while there was a constitutional amendment and while there is the law, the governor and the clemency board, they have the right now to restore voting rights and all civil rights to ex-felons. Mm-hmm. And so, but they're still operating under the rules that were put in place by Rick Scott back in 2011, and which has all sorts of obstacles for people in terms of when they can apply.
Always good to get your insights. He's Gary Fineout with Politico, joining us from WMFE in Orlando. Danny Rivero of WLRN reporting on this issue. Thanks for your work, Danny. And Neil Voltz with us from Fort Myers with the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Gentlemen, thanks for appearing on the Florida Roundup today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Twenty-two communities in Florida have passed bans on conversion therapy, but Tampa's ban is no longer in place. It was just last week that a federal judge struck down the ban in Tampa. It was a 41-page ruling. A U.S. District Court judge banned the prohibition, saying that the city did not have the authority to regulate the practice of medicine. Lawyers for the city of Tampa will decide whether to appeal the ruling in the next week.
Now, conversion therapy is an effort to change an individual's sexual orientation or their gender identity through psychotherapy, counseling, or intensive gender performative camps. It has been discredited by the scientific and the psychiatric communities, and it's actually been banned in 18 states. The controversial treatment was a hot topic last night on CNN's Equality Town Hall. Several Democratic presidential candidates promised to ban conversion therapy nationwide if they're elected. Here's former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
It should be illegal. As president, we will seek to outlaw it everywhere in this country. In my opinion, this is tantamount to torture. A torture that we're visiting on children who are absolutely defenseless.
So it is not illegal in the state of Florida. Have you experienced conversion therapy? Would you take your child to a therapist for this therapy? Do you support banning conversion therapy, or do you support having conversion therapy as a practice. 305-995-1800 as we talk about it now statewide on the Florida Roundup. 305-995-1800 or on Twitter at Florida Roundup.
As we talk about this, we need to note that today is actually National Coming Out Day. The Human Rights Campaign is celebrating the 31st anniversary today of Coming Out Day and honoring all Americans who have come out as LGBTQ. We're going to begin the discussion here by talking a little bit more about conversion therapy, how it works, and why it's so controversial. As we welcome John Harris Maurer, he's the Public Policy Director of Equality Florida. Also with us, Sarah Rogers, a reporter with the Daily Beast who has covered the movement to ban conversion therapy here in the Sunshine State. John Harris, let's begin with you. Conversion therapy is primarily something that religious groups practice. Tell us a little bit more about why Equality Florida is opposed.
Sure. Thank you for having me, and thank you for also recognizing National Coming Out Day. We know that conversion therapy is not just ineffective, but it's in fact harmful and can be deadly. It's incredibly important to Equality Florida to tackle this fraudulent and dangerous practice because minors are incredibly at risk of these practices. We know that when LGBTQ young folks are coming out, they really need family support. In fact, a recent study found that LGBTQ youth who experience high levels of family rejection are 8 times more likely to attempt suicide, 6 times more likely to report high levels of depression, and 3 times more likely to use illegal drugs. We need to be affirming these young folks, not telling them that their sexual orientation or gender identity are wrong and something that needs to be fixed. We need to be telling them that they are born perfect.
Now, this case in Tampa was argued and was overturned. The ban in Tampa was overturned by the judge last week. We invited a representative from Liberty Counsel, who successfully sued to overturn that ban, to join our discussion today. They declined our invitation to appear. Previously, though, the founder and chairman of Liberty Counsel, Matt Staver, said that critics overestimate the harm of the procedure. Here's what he said.
They create a straw man, and they use words like conversion therapy, which is not a term used by counselors. It's never been a term used by counselors. And what takes place is simply what takes place in any counseling.
Now, the Liberty Counsel was making a constitutional argument in court. The judge didn't necessarily make a constitutional decision. Instead, it was about home rule, and we'll talk about that in a second. But John Harris, I want to ask you, how prevalent is the practice, in your estimation, in Florida?
Thank you for the question, and I'll say, in fact, that is the most frequent question I get when I'm talking about conversion therapy around the state is, does this actually still happen? And of course we know it does, because those practitioners who want to continue this practice, archaic and harmful as it is, are the ones who are bringing these lawsuits, both the one in the Middle District challenging Tampa's ban that was just overturned, as well as the challenge in the Southern District of Florida, where Liberty Counsel made the exact same arguments, and in fact they lost that case on the preliminary injunction. So we know that it is still happening, unfortunately. And it remains a widespread risk for our LGBTQ youth.
Sarah Rogers, reporter with the Daily Beast, you've covered the movement to ban conversion therapy here in Florida, particularly in Orlando, which of course was the site of the Pulse massacre that hit the LGBTQ community so hard. It's a particularly sensitive issue in Orlando, as you found, correct?
Hi, yes, that's absolutely correct. I think that in the wake of Pulse, you know, the LGBT community really came together in Orlando and is hailed as something of a community that's very inclusive. So the fact that it's still prevalent there is a sore spot for sure.
And you spoke with people who have experienced conversion therapy. How did they describe it to you?
Sure. One conversion therapy survivor I spoke to told me that it was not only damaging mentally, but for it had physical manifestations. She had a chronic illness that flares with stress, and the intense stress and trauma of conversion therapy made her so physically ill she was hospitalized. Another therapy survivor I spoke to went through conversion therapy camp that was basically, you know, the home of a religious counselor, and he told me the experience was incredibly intrusive. He was made to disclose all of his thoughts and fantasies to the counselor. He had to install spyware on his computer, so he was deterred from looking at porn. You know, just a lot of shaming tactics that are inherently made to make these people feel bad about themselves and to feel like there's something inherently wrong with them.
Well, that's at the heart of this. You know, right. Whether or not you believe that gender nonconforming people, gay people, lesbians, transgender people, John Harris, whether or not they are somehow sinning or even mentally ill. This is those types of ideas about LGBTQ people have been broadly rejected by the majority of Americans. We live in a land now of marriage equality. Psychiatrists and you know, the medical community, we need to know, they've discredited conversion therapy. So this isn't something that medical professionals sanction, correct?
Absolutely. In fact, every mainstream medical and mental health association has debunked this practice, and many of them have recognized the extreme harms of conversion therapy and the long-standing impacts that it has. You know, the Williams Institute out of UCLA expects that 20,000 minors in those states where it hasn't been banned will be subjected to conversion therapy, despite all of this overwhelming scientific evidence and consensus from the leading mental and mental health associations about its harms and its ineffectiveness.
It's banned in 18 states, but that is less than half the states. So a majority of states still allow this practice, including Florida. What about the argument that private groups should have the right to do this?
Well, these bans really focus on the behaviors of licensed professionals. There are certainly a lot of other contexts in which conversion therapy may occur, and these bans haven't targeted all of those. I mean, long term, I think one day we will recognize this as a dangerous and archaic practice, and it will ultimately be banned nationwide. But right now, what we're talking about is what licensed therapists and medical practitioners can practice. And if they're practicing in Florida, they should be practicing good medicine.
Conversion therapy is our topic here on the Florida Roundup. Your phone calls at 305-995-1800. Your tweets at Florida Roundup. All ahead after the quick break. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. As we continue talking about the overturning of a ban on conversion therapy in the city of Tampa, with John Harris Maurer of Equality Florida and reporter Sarah Rogers of The Daily Beast, what are your thoughts? It's 305-995-1800. Let's go over to Jim in Gainesville right now. Hey, Jim, thanks for calling the Florida Roundup. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm the parent of a transgender child. I guess he's not a child anymore. He's over 21. He's going through transition therapy to become a woman. LGBT, it's not a choice. I caught my kid shaving his legs at 4 years old. And this transition therapy is nothing. It's not going to accomplish anything. And we just need to stand by our kids and support them.
Jim, thanks for that. And, you know, Sarah Rogers, when you speak to LGBTQ people, they will tell you, as Jim just mentioned, that they did not choose to be the way they are. Conversion therapy seems to be operating under the assumption that you can somehow make someone choose a different path, rather than accepting that this is something that is innate in a person. How did the people you spoke to in Florida talk about that with you?
Yeah, so one survivor that I spoke to, Jordan, told me, you know, that it is all rooted in shame, right? Like the kind of conditioning that goes on in conversion therapy is ultimately meant to make you break down and feel bad about yourself. So that's what leads to depression, anxiety, PTSD. There's, you know, a number of negative consequences to this practice. So, you know, really being subjected to this really is just there's no silver lining here. It's just a negative thing that breaks people down.
Alexander, our next caller on line four in Miami. Go ahead, Alexander. You're on the radio.
Thank you for having me on. I'm familiar with the topic. I'd like to say this. What about the minor who wants to actively seek out counseling? What about him or her? We're squelching the rights of the child or the minor to seek out counseling. These type of laws would forbid counseling our minors on matters such as sexuality and sexual identity, matters that should remain within the purview of parents, teachers, and counselors and pastors. Now, sexual dysphoria is quite common in teens and adolescents, and sometimes they themselves find themselves with unwanted same-sex attractions. What about that? Are we going to squelch and marginalize those arguments? And I'm very disappointed that we do not have both sides of the argument presented here.
Alexander, let me address that. We did invite Liberty Counsel to the program to present their side. That was the group that sued successfully to overturn the ban in Tampa. They did not accept our invitation to appear. So it is not for the lack of wanting or the lack of effort on our part to have both sides represented, but a fair point nonetheless, Alexander. Appreciate those comments here. John Harris Maurer with the Equality Florida. You heard Alexander's comments there, and the idea that this is a personal decision to seek this kind of therapy or to seek any type of therapy, especially for minors. It ought to be something that is between a parent or a pastor, in his case, or a therapist. How do you address that ability or that freedom to choose this type of therapy, should there be a desire for it?
Sure. Great question. And first, I actually want to refer back to the first caller, Jim in Gainesville, and thank him for supporting his daughter as she transitions. You know, that sort of family support is so critical when we think about the well-being of our LGBTQ youth. And with respect to the second question from Miami, I think that really reflects a misunderstanding about what these ordinances protecting against conversion therapy do. They are very narrowly tailored, and it is only about what licensed medical professionals can do. They're not seeking to regulate the conversations that a parent may have with their children or what faith leaders may do in their ecumenical capacities. We're just talking about practicing good medicine in the state of Florida and ways to keep our LGBTQ youth safe and protected from this fraudulent and debunked practice.
John Harris, let me ask you some questions real quick just about the legal arguments that were made in the Tampa case. Liberty Counsel, which was the plaintiff here and won the overturn, was making initially a freedom of speech and freedom of religion claim here. But the judge, however, found essentially that the Tampa City Council didn't have the right to regulate health care, didn't rule on the constitutionality of any kind of prohibition to conversion therapy, but instead health care and regulating health care sits with the state legislature in Florida, not with city councils.
Absolutely. And we certainly believe that these bans are constitutional and they should remain in force across the state. Importantly, the judge in the Middle District Tampa case didn't dispute that conversion therapy is ineffective and dangerous. We certainly also disagree with the ruling to the extent that local governments have the ability and a responsibility to protect their residents and keep them safe from serious harms. So we certainly think that those local bans should stay in place, and we appreciate the judge bringing attention to this issue and would love to see statewide action so that Florida can join the 18 other states, D.C. and Puerto Rico, that have all taken steps.
Essentially, the judge put this at the doorstep of the legislature, but the ruling in Tampa is in conflict with the ruling in Boca Raton in the Southern District, the federal Southern District in Florida.
Doesn't that mean that eventually the Supreme Court could decide this, John Harris? Isn't that what the path of this might be?
There's certainly a possibility. We've already seen two federal appellate circuit courts that have upheld state bans. It's part of why we know that these sort of protections are constitutional, but you do now have a difference between the Middle District and the Southern District in Florida, and the 11th Circuit is already taking a review of the Southern District case.
Okay, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Lots of tweets coming in from around the state about conversion therapy. Prin writes, "My dad forced me to go to conversion therapy at age 15. It caused me to hate myself and become suicidal and still affects me 9 years later. Young people should not be forced into this harmful practice. It happened to me at my church, which can still happen even with the ban. Here's a tweet from Michael. While Equality Florida's work mainly focuses on practitioners, we've seen the huge harm that's been done by private and religious groups. We should be uncompromising in protecting LGBTQ kids. Paula tweets, attempting to convert a gay person to a straight one is no more appropriate than trying to convert a straight person to a gay person. Okay, Sarah Rogers, lots of strong sentiment on social media coming into the Florida Roundup right now about conversion therapy. For the most part, our listeners are in line with the notion of LGBTQ equality and seem to feel that this is a harmful practice. What are some more insights you can share from your reporting on this?
Yeah, I mean, just to echo what John had mentioned, you know, there's no scientific evidence that this works. You know, it's been debunked. It's been denounced by every major mental health organization. And from talking to people who have gone through it and from the tweets that you just read, clearly it's traumatizing and it makes people hate themselves. It makes people suicidal. And, you know, there's really no reason for it. Mm.
Jimmy in Orlando on line six has some experience that he wants to share. Jimmy, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. So I just wanted to share my experience. Like I was mentioning, I was born in Ecuador, and my parents live over there. I'm the only one living here. And a few years back, a little bit after I had come out to my parents, I guess I've been contacting some conversion places, and he begged me to go and you know, and check him out and try him out. This place was in Maryland. I lived in Miami at the time. Mm-hmm. And so he said, just give him a call, talk to them. I tell that was very unacceptable. I mean, it really made me feel bad because, as I said, it had been already a few years that they had known that I was gay, and they still wanted to try and convert me and change me. And so I did give it a try and call this place, and after he begged me so many times of doing it, I thought it was completely unacceptable for me to go ahead and call this place knowing who I was. And I gave him a chance, and I called him, and the gentleman was actually very good. I mean, I think this was completely the opposite of what most of the places are. I explained the situation, and he basically asked me, well, do you want to change? Do you want to convert back to being straight? And on, I said, like, no, I feel comfortable being gay. And so then he said, well, there's really not much for me to do here, you know, then I will just contact your father and let him know the situation.
And you left it there. Yeah. Jimmy, thanks for sharing that experience. John Harris, what do you hear in Jimmy's story?
Jimmy, thank you for sharing your story. I want to thank Prin for sharing their story as well. Unfortunately, we have far too many of these traumatic stories in Florida and elsewhere. And we know from research by the Trevor Project that 42% of youth subjected to conversion therapy reported a suicide attempt in the last year. And that's just wholly unacceptable. We can't keep subjecting our LGBTQ youth to these sort of barbaric practices.
Well, we really thank you both for sharing your insights about conversion therapy in the state of Florida with us. As Tom noted, we did air a previous statement from Liberty Counsel, who's on the other side of this issue. However, they did decline our invitation to appear today. We'll follow this case. As you pointed out, John Harris, it may go all the way to the Supreme Court. John Harris Maurer with us. He's the Public Policy Director of Equality Florida. Also joining the show today to talk about conversion therapy, Sarah Rogers, a reporter at the Daily Beast. She's been covering the movement to ban conversion therapy in Florida. Thank you both so much for being on the show today. Great to have you. We appreciate your insights this Friday. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And thanks for everyone who called, emailed, and tweeted us here on the Florida Roundup about this topic. You can always tweet us anytime. We get a lot of tweets, Tom, at Florida Roundup. And that is our show. Thanks so much for engaging with us today. The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming and our Technical Director this hour. The WLRN Director of Radio Operations is Peter Meritz. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Brady Corum. Our theme music is from Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday at noon.